Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. I'm Kate Koff, editor of the Maine Monitor. The Maine Monitor is the nonpartisan, independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to delivering high-quality, nonpartisan, investigative, and explanatory journalism to inform Mainers about issues impacting our state and to empower them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. Each month, a panel of reporters and editors will talk about the stories we're working on, many of which you've likely read in your local newspaper or at themainemonitor.org. This month, I'm joined by the Monitor's government accountability reporter, Josh Keith, to talk about Maine's housing crisis and, more specifically, to talk about a fight over a proposed housing development in Northeast Harbor. So, Josh, obviously housing is a huge issue for people here in Maine, and it's something we think a lot about at the Monitor. We hear a lot about the pushback that some of these larger housing complexes have gotten around the state and about concerns from neighbors over density and environmental issues. But this project in Northeast Harbor is a little bit different. Can you tell us what makes this development unique and why you're interested in writing about it?
Sure. Happy to. Good to be with you, Kate. So this development it's one lot. It's about 1 acre. It's 6 units. That's what was proposed. It's 2 duplexes and 2 houses and sort of a garage for everybody. So it's small. I mean, you know, we hear about developments, affordable housing projects, you know, dozens and dozens of units. This is a very sort of small one. They're not really asking for a whole lot here. But it's unique because it's in the town, it's in the village of Northeast Harbor, which is part of the town of Mount Desert, which is on Mount Desert Island. You know, Mount Desert Island is one of the most beautiful places on the planet, as far as I'm concerned. I'm sure you agree living there.
I
grew up in Bangor and we always would, you know, my parents would bring us, you know, every weekend in the summer, seemed like, to go hiking. I definitely didn't appreciate it then as much as I do now, but, it's the island is, there's one bridge in, one bridge out, and it's forever been, for a century or more, has been a playground for some of America's richest people, from Rockefeller to Ford to the Vanderbilts, and still that way.
But there's a real challenge there, in that there's just not enough housing for the people to actually do the work there, to live and work there. You know, there's housing, obviously there's housing challenges all over Maine, all over the country, but Maine specifically. But what's happening there is, you know, businesses are having to buy housing and build housing just to have workers. The library in Northeast Harbor had to buy a house for its director because the director couldn't find housing. There's a desperate need for the kind of for housing for middle class people to sort of do the job, whether it's working for the national park, whether it's working in the school system, whether it's working in the fire department. They can't hire people to do the jobs that sort of keep the place going. Because there's not enough housing for them. And part of the reason why there isn't enough housing is because there's been a huge, since the pandemic, especially there's just been a huge amount of housing has been bought up from people from other areas and turned into summer homes or short-term rentals. So anyway, all this is to say that this is sort of a desperate need in Northeast Harbor. It's a very small, pretty modest workforce housing project. And what's interesting here is not that the town didn't reject it, voters didn't reject it. It's being held up by 7 incredibly wealthy individuals suing to stop it. And they've managed to kind of ground it to a halt.
Now, so housing prices have obviously gone up all over Maine, as you mentioned, but they went up really dramatically in Mount Desert, where the village of Northeast Harbor is. I think your reporting showed that the median home price there is now more than $900,000, which is double what it was 5 years ago. Talk to us a little bit about the origins of that increase. You mentioned some of them, the pandemic, but the problem really starts before that. Why did the housing prices increase so dramatically in Mount Desert and in Northeast Harbor in particular?
Yeah, I mean, they've talked about the problem of affordable housing. And I guess I don't mean that in the sort of legal sense of affordable low-income housing. I just mean in terms of housing that working class people and even sort of upper middle class people can afford for a long time. You know, you go back, look at their comprehensive plans from 2009, they start saying how this is an issue. We have to develop year-round housing. But what happened was couple things. One, the advent of Airbnb, short-term rental, all of a sudden those properties, those houses that used to be year-round houses for people living there year-round became incredibly profitable to turn into short-term rental opportunities. You can make a lot of money buying those and then, to be in a place like Northeast Harbor, for a week in the summer, people pay a lot of money for that. So you can quickly sort of, those investment opportunities are very attractive for a lot of people. And then, there's the pandemic, I think, exacerbated a lot of these issues. I also think Airbnb, I should say, going back a little bit, Airbnb made it so that people could afford summer homes there in ways they couldn't before. Maybe they couldn't, they couldn't afford to have a second home before, things like Airbnb, but then Airbnb comes along, you rent it out, some of the time, make enough money to afford to have a summer home for two of the months of the summer, whatever it may be. So it created a lot more opportunity there for people to, and incentivize people to essentially buy year-round housing and turn it into summer homes or short-term rentals. And the pandemic just exacerbated that there, as it did all over Maine. I think it was between 2012 and 2022, obviously this is going back before the pandemic, the town's population has shrunk by 20%, while the seasonal vacancy rate, which is the homes, that aren't occupied year-round, grew from 46 to 60%. Wow. To give you the context there, the statewide seasonal vacancy rate is like 16%. It can be much higher in other places, but on the island, that's the highest in the town of Mount Desert. This has sort of been a long time coming, but like a lot of things, the pandemic has sort of exacerbated a problem that was already there. And as a result, home prices are now the median home price is now nearly $1 million.
Wow, a seasonal vacancy rate of 60%. That's huge.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about, what the impacts of that vacancy rate and this housing crisis have been on the town and the services in town. You mentioned that the library director couldn't find housing and that the library actually had to rent a house specifically for the director.
They actually bought it.
Oh, they bought it. They bought the house. Like
whoever's coming next is going to need housing too, because they're not going to be able to afford it either.
Yeah. So they're really Yeah. So what have some of the effects of this been on the town and on the services there?
Well, I talked to the town manager, Derlin Lunt, and he talked about how there's basically a premium on a tax sort of on all their services now, because they have to get them from so far away. Every contractor has to come from further and further away because none can afford to live there. They have to pay, firefighters way more money than they would otherwise, because they have to come from way further away. And you can see this, which is sort of most interesting, I think, in the fact that the last few years, property values have skyrocketed, right? So you would think, now the town is bringing in so much more money because the tax rate, if the tax rate stays the same, and properties double in value over a few years, you would think that would mean that we can lower taxes because we're getting so much more money into the town's coffers. But that's actually not the case. The mill rate has been going up as the town's property has increased in value. So basically what that's saying is that all that extra money they've been getting in from property value skyrocketing hasn't offset the rising costs. And, you know, the sort of best example of that is they had a volunteer ambulance service that was a nonprofit volunteer group. And they basically had to go to the town and be like, listen, there's not enough volunteers anymore to do this. And, you know, people seem to think that's because there's just no people living there year round anymore who are able to do this. Or, you know, I mean, there's sort of also a conversation there about the spirit of volunteerism in America. But I think what people seem to think is that just because people can't live there year round anymore, there's not this pool of volunteers to choose from. So the town had to take over the ambulance service and basically combine it with a fire department. And it costs, you know, $6 million to build these two different firehouses and hire a bunch of firefighters / EMTs that could do both. And so that costs a lot of money, and they can't, you know, they're trying to hire they have people driving from Old Town to work at that firehouse, and they're trying to get people from around the country. And the fire chief told me, like, yeah, every interview is like, well, you know, you might want to come here, but please look at the housing first and see if you can find something. And usually what happens is they look at the housing and they say, oh, never mind, I can't afford there, there's nothing there. So, you know, the lack of housing isn't just affecting people who can't find housing. It's affecting people with housing who, you know, want the services of fire department. It's, you know, who want, you know, plumbers and electricians that don't have to come from hours away. Like, there's this real issue with just getting basic services. And then it hurts business owners. I mean, so many business owners told me, like, first question anyone asks they try to hire is, do you offer housing? You basically have to offer housing in a lot of situations to hire anybody. So now basically the costs of housing are being put onto businesses. And some businesses, like, you know, the National Park is building seasonal housing. The National Park Service is building seasonal housing in a bunch of different places. Jackson Lab has built seasonal housing. But those are big, huge kind of, you know, companies, organizations. When you're talking about ma and pa, you know, bed and breakfast, it's not that easy for them to build housing to get workers. So it's affected everybody, not just those who can't find a place to live.
Yeah. And we should say, you know, we're talking about people who are looking to buy houses, but of course this is also really impacting anyone who wants to rent a house, because rents have also gone up significantly if you can find a place that's year round.
Right. I mean, especially you're talking about, especially you're talking about, you know, short-term rentals, Airbnbs, like, you know, you can make so much money, you know, renting out for a week at a time, as opposed to, you know, sort of middle-class worker for an entire summer. Speaking of that, I mean, Bar Harbor has instituted a short-term rental ordinance. All these other towns on the island have not. And part of the reason is because there's a lot of people who own houses in these communities who also have camps, you know, in the woods or on the water, on the lakes. And in the summer, a lot of times what they will do is rent out Airbnb out their home and go live at these camps and make some money that way. And there's a worry that these kind of ordinances will prevent them from doing that, although they weren't written that way. So it's a little unclear what the impact would be, but yeah. So Bar Harbor is the only community there that's regulated these. Hmm.
So let's go back to this particular development, which is called Keel Way is the name of it. Now, this is a story that really spans several years. There's a lot of back and forth, both with kind of the planning board and, you know, at the courts, as you mentioned, because this did involve a lawsuit. Tell me a bit about how you started reporting on this. Where did you begin and why did you start there? What did you do first?
Well, I think I saw, I started because I read about it in the Bangor Daily News. I think Bill Trotter wrote an article about the lawsuit that these wealthy residents, part-time residents, I mean, summer residents. So, I mean, I guess the use of the term resident, yeah, it's a little squishy. But I read about that and I thought, well, that's weird. You know, a bunch of summer residents who own homes there suing to stop workforce housing. And then I saw that it was just 6 units. And I was like, well, that seems strange. So I started digging in. I mean, first of all, I got the lawsuit. And at first I didn't understand it at all, to be honest, because it was all this talk about ordinances. I mean, there's no sort of central argument they're making. They're making arguments based on calculations of lot sizes and just these very technical, esoteric sort of legal arguments. But anyway, yeah, I started to talk to some of the people behind the project and, you know, just trying to understand what the need was in the community, talking to different people there, went up, saw the lot, saw the area, sort of saw where the neighbors were that were suing to stop. Although some of them aren't neighbors, quite frankly, they're way down the road. But I think it really fascinated me because it's taking all these issues that I think are happening all over Maine, which is a lack of housing, you know, efforts to stop a building of new housing, but it's sort of, you know, it's sort of an example that is bigger and grander sort of than our places, because you have, I mean, the people suing are millionaires. And, you know, I say that like on the low end of millionaires, probably hundreds of millions of dollars. A lot of these people and the people behind trying to build it, the main driving force are two brothers, the Rails brothers, who are billionaires. So it's sort of millionaires versus billionaires in, one of the most, I think, iconic, beautiful places in Maine. It's sort of all these issues across Maine, but sort of, I don't know, magnified, I guess, which is why I found it so interesting.
Yeah. We need to take a quick break here. So if you're just joining us, you're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU-FM. This month, we're here with the Monitor's government accountability reporter, Josh Keefe, talking about housing in Maine and the fight over a small development in Northeast Harbor. So let's go back. I want you to take us back, actually, before the project, back to the formation of the group that is behind Healway. The name of the group is Mount Desert 365. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about why that group formed and who was behind it.
Yeah, so that group formed, as was explained to me, because in 2016, I believe, there was a cruise ship that showed up in Northeast Harbor and unloaded some people. And people were not happy about that, because I think there was a sense, and I think it's a sense a lot of places, that once the cruise ship starts showing up, there's trouble. You know, it's sort of a harbinger of a sort of unfettered tourism, and, you know, just a lot of people hawking, you know, t-shirts and other sort of items there in town, and sort of the destruction of local business. Like, I'm not saying that's necessarily true, but I think that was sort of the thought. And so there was pretty quickly ordinances passed that barred cruise ships from coming in the harbor or letting people out in the harbor. But during that conversation, I guess a lot of the local business owners were like, hey, the day the cruise ship came in was like the best day we've had in years. So like, what are you going to do to help out? We're dying. And this was good for us. And we understand that, you know, people don't want cruise ships here, but like, what are we going to do? So as a result, some people seems to be mostly backed by money from Mitch and Stephen Rails, who are billionaires who own a bunch of property in the area. They formed this organization with the goal of basically helping, reviving the year-round community that had been dwindling for years in Northeast Harbor and Mount Desert, the town of Mount Desert more widely. And so part of that was, one of the early recognitions, I guess, was we need for people to live here year-round and go to these local businesses and support them. We need places for these people to live year-round. So they started buying up property in the area. They have a bunch of different properties they've bought, including their sort of headquarters, sort of overlooking the harbor, that they have two workforce housing apartments sort of as part of that building. And, their goal is to build these workforce housing units as many as they can, presumably, to fill this need. And I guess I should define what workforce housing is. A workforce housing it's not really a strict legal term, but the idea is that you're taking housing and you're sort of capping how much somebody's going to have to pay for it. If that could be rent, you're capping a certain amount. In this case, at the Healway project, these are houses that people would buy, or units that people buy. Ones, there's duplexes, so you buy your half. And the idea is to cap it. When they originally started this a few years ago, the quotes they got were it would be between $250,000 and $275,000. And so the idea is that's
per unit for somebody to buy one. Sorry, per unit for somebody to buy one.
Right. And the idea is you cap the price and then you also cap how much money somebody can make who's living there. So in this case, it was like 160% of the median income in Maine for a family of four. And, depending on the family member, how many people in the family, it moves a little bit. But and that would be so 160% would be about 70,000. The median is about 70,000. So 160% would be 118,000 a year. And then the bottom is you have to be able to get financing to buy it, right? So if you don't make enough money to get a loan, you're not going to be able to get it. So again, it's not like affordable housing. It's not subsidized housing. There's no tax breaks here that are being used. It is just this developer saying, we're going to put this we're going to try to make them this cheap, and to get them, you have to make below this certain amount. And that's sort of where the controversy starts.
Before we get into the controversy, which there is a lot of, as you've alluded to, give us a little, for people who haven't spent time in Northeast Harbor, give us a sense of what this lot actually looks like and what's around it. You said, it's about an acre. Is there anything there now? Like what's there? What's around the space?
Yeah, it's a 0.9 acre lot. It's a corner lot. There's a house on it right now and then there's a big five bay garage on there. It's a lot of empty space. I guess the people used to live there would grow vegetables and sell them. So there's sort of that. And then there's a lot of woods sort of in the back. And it's this very short walk to the elementary school, which is part of the reason they chose it. They want families to live there. Kids can walk, right up the hill there. And it's sort of on the edge of the village. And it's sort of the corner lot. It's sort of across the street are houses that are on the water, essentially. And part of the street that sort of runs in front of it is, part of one of the things that people complained about this project being there is that that's a street that kids ride their bikes in the summer between the tennis club and the yacht club. So it's sort of in the town. It's by all these, things that, you know, you hear tennis club, swim club, yacht club. It's sort of a class signifier, but, it's also, you know, it's within walking distance of the, the sort of the heart of the village of Northeast Harbor, which is, you know, sort of the most idyllic, quaint New England, village, you know, touristy type of village. It's, you know, it's got galleries and art places, and it's beautiful. It's very nice. And so it's all sort of right there. And the idea is that, like, we're going to build this in a place where we need the people, you know, and near schools and near places where we need workers. Right now it's basically a house that's been sitting there for a while. And then sort of where it really gets tricky is it's just down the road, third of a mile, maybe less. There is a private road that goes down this point, and those are that smallish point, and that's full of houses, you know, multi-million dollar houses, and that's where a lot of the people suing to stop this live.
So, Mount Desert 365 buys this property,
mm-hmm.
puts forward a plan. Take us briefly through the plan and then tell us what happened after that.
So it's sort of a long process. They originally sort of bring what's called a sketch plan to the planning board in 2021. It doesn't really get started through the actual planning board process till a couple of years later in 2023. But basically, when there's a lot of people who get wind of it, neighbors and stuff, and they make a petition against it. They say it's too dense. Like, that's the main argument that that sort of the people opposing it are making, is that it's too dense. It's too much housing on too small a lot. People are going to be cramped in there. It's going to add traffic. Basically, what they keep saying is, like, in this petition, they say, you know, we've put ourselves in the shoes of the people who will live there, and we don't think there's enough space. A lot of these people are living in multi-million dollar houses, so it's sort of, maybe they don't want to live there, but I certainly talked to many people in town who would want to live there. But that's their main argument. It's too dense. And throughout it, there's this planning board process that takes place mostly over the course of 2023, where there are these meetings where people bring up, you know, just make it 3 units instead of 6. I have no problem with 3 units instead of 6. And MD 365 basically keeps saying, like, no, the law says that we can do this here. We're within the law. This is a great need. We need to do as much as we can on this property. What they're not saying as much is that the more dense housing is built, the cheaper it is. You know, it's if you build one house on one lot, that's, you know, if you can build 6 on that same lot, you're saving yourself a lot of money per unit. So I think that's part of it. But yeah. There's a lot of talk about the traffic that will, from all these extra cars in there, that will, you know, make it dangerous on the roads. They did a traffic study. I think they said it was 3 to 4 more cars an hour during peak summer months. We're talking about adding that onto a total of 500 cars a day. It's kind of a negligible amount. There's just a lot of arguments. I mean, I watch a lot of these proceedings, and like it's hard to come away with any other conclusion than people are just throwing stuff at a wall and seeing what sticks. As far as the opposition, it's hard to find an argument that I think really holds up in terms of how it will affect the community, other than it's different than what it is now. And a lot of people who've been there for years supporting the project are like, it's already different. It's different because we used to have year-round housing here, and now it's all summer houses. And, you know, this town is dead in the winter. So, you know, you guys are the ones who've essentially changed the sort of fabric of this town. So that fight goes on for a while. And then the planning board ultimately approves the project 3-1. So there was the chair of the planning board did vote that it would change, I forget, the compatibility of the project. It was not compatible with the other areas, which is somewhat subjective term there. But it goes, it passes, and then these seven residents immediately sue to stop it. They lose in court. The judge basically says, like, yeah, it strikes down all their arguments. Doesn't really, I mean, it's pretty, there's not a lot of close calls, at least from the judge's perspective. You know, that's what I get from reading that decision. And then they appeal again to the Maine Supreme Court, which is where the case is headed. And we haven't got a date for that yet. But so the project is on hold through this entire period. And the town has spent $55,000 on legal fees at the last I checked. And it'll probably have to spend more as this moves forward.
You mentioned the density. I know in your story, you talked a little bit about the fact that Maine had recently passed a statewide change to zoning laws that required, you know, the allowance of density on certain lots. And so under the old density ordinance in Northeast Harbor, actually this project would not have been approved, correct? But the updated one, it was allowed.
Right. But the thing is that the town of Mount Desert, which again is the village of Northeast Harbor, is in the town of Mount Desert. They changed this. They changed their zoning laws to allow for greater density and what's called a workforce housing bonus, which basically you can get more dense if you reserve some of the housing for workforce, you know, with the workforce sort of limits that we discussed earlier. They changed that law like more than a decade ago. And then this law that was passed in 2022, I believe, LD 2003, basically made municipalities throughout the state had to update their ordinances to allow greater density on single family lots, and to also allow for the construction of ADUs, accessory dwelling units. So in a lot of ways, Mount Desert was way ahead on this. I mean, they're a decade ahead or more from what the state is sort of mandating other communities do. The thing about these laws are like, you know, you can sort of allow them, but somebody has to actually go do it. Somebody has to actually build. And, you know, there is workforce housing projects in town. The thing is, no one's really tried to do it sort of in the heart of town. And I think more importantly, you know, the organization that was doing these workforce housing projects, not Mount Desert 365, but Island Housing Trust, they have to raise money from the richest people on the island to build these workforce housing projects. So, I mean, there's sort of a clash of interest there. Do you want to upset your donors by building things that might make them less likely to donate to you, that might, you know, have cause resistance? Think about MD 365 is for a while, they had 2 billionaire donors on board. So they didn't really need to sort of massage the rich people in town and keep the property, their workforce housing, away from them in order to then get money from them. So, yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, Mount Desert, it was way ahead of the rest of the state. But, you know, sort of the devil's in the details. And when you actually start to try to take advantage of these laws, you're going to get resistance.
We need to take another break. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU-FM. This month, we're here with the Monitor's government accountability reporter, Josh Keefe, talking about housing in Maine and the fight over small development in Northeast Harbor. I want to talk now a little bit about some of the people on either side of this issue. You start your story with an anecdote about a man named Steve Anastasia, who's a maintenance worker for Acadia National Park and who has, you know, long looked for a home on a permanent home on Mount Desert Island. Tell us a little bit about Steve and just tell us a little bit about his story.
Yeah, Steve. I became aware of Steve because he, was watching all these recordings of all these meetings, and he had stood up and talked a few different times about when there was one moment in a meeting where essentially one of the opposition was like, "Well, who's going to live here? Who are these people?" You know. And Steve stood up and was kind of like, I have lived in workforce housing. I live in workforce housing now. I am the person, you know? And he said, I work for Acadia National Park. I've been part of all these different community organizations. He had very popular, from what I hear, sort of bakery, he ran. So he sort of made that clear. So I was like, all right, well, I want to talk to this guy. And Steve originally came to the island in 2013 with his then spouse and children. And he got our workforce housing house near Soamesville in a development that was made by Island Housing Trust. And he, at some point, him and his spouse got divorced, and he was trying to find a place to live on the island. And he was like, it's not possible. You know, it's just, it was a couple of years ago and it's only gotten worse. So he was able to live in the apartment that MDI 365, one of the two, the MD 365 has sort of attached to its headquarters. And he's talked about, he's been following this project for, you know, the last couple of years. And he tells me he walks by it sometimes and just, you know, sort of walks around town and sort of imagines, you know, it'll be when it's complete and him and his sort of one chance, he feels like kind of his one chance to own a home on the island. Hmm. And so he's been, he's been sort of vocal about wanting it there. And, you know, he knows all the details of the plans and he says, you know, too dense, it doesn't bother him. You know, he wants to live there. He says he's kind of holding out for the possibility that this will get done. And he can have a place, where his kids can come. He works for the park and the park is in desperate need of workers. They're building all sorts of seasonal, housing. The park services. But that's seasonal, you know, for people who live here, want to live there year round, like Steve, and he has for more than a decade. It's a real challenge.
And now what is the town's attitude then toward this plan?
I think the town government has been very supportive. Mm-hmm. It's sort of, the town itself, I think, is a little bit divided. You know, there's been petitions for, petitions against. Mm-hmm. They're both about 200 something. They're sort of similar numbers. It never went to a vote, you know, so it's hard to sort of say exactly. But, and, you know, I think there is, that what's happening in, I guess what I would say is, in Mount Desert is very interesting because, like a lot of places like this, you know, the summer residents pay a large amount of taxes because they own multi-million dollar properties in many cases. And so a lot of the lion's share of the town's budget is provided by these summer residents, but they don't live there, so they can't vote. So there's this interesting dynamic where there's sort of, you know, the voters are not the people paying taxes the same way. I'm not saying they don't, but, you know, most places that's sort of that Venn diagram is one circle, right? In this case, they're sort of separate. So yeah, like I think the Summer Residents Association, there's this group that they have there, you know, because they don't get to vote, they have sort of, they want to have a say in things. My understanding is that they never took a position because there was, you know, so much their membership was sort of split on this. There's a lot of summer residents who want this and see, you know, who've argued for it in public hearings or messages to the planning board. But you know, there are definitely people against it too. So it's hard to say sort of what the actual polling would look like. But yeah, I mean, it's also hard to tell sort of, you know, there's loud voices on both sides. It's hard to see sort of how much that is representative of people, you know, in mass. But yeah, it's definitely been divisive, though, I would say.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about some of the folks on the other side, particularly those who have been involved in this lawsuit. So tell us a little bit about the lawsuit and some of the people who are the plaintiffs here.
Yeah, I think what was interesting to me, I mean, was so some of the plaintiffs, there's seven plaintiffs. A couple of them live right nearby. One of them is sort of like directly on the property line. His driveway, him and his wife's driveway is right on the property line where this development would be. So I think that, you know, it's hard to say exactly. But like, I think I have a certain amount of sympathy for that person, maybe not wanting the project there. There's also, you know, down the road, there's another road that says, you know, private, do not enter. And there is it goes out to a point, as I said before, the end of that point is a private bridge that goes to the yacht club. And these are multi-million dollar mansions. And these people are suing. So there's, everyone's rich who's suing, but some are like, have a little more skin in the game, so to speak, than others. But a lot of these people are descendants from incredibly wealthy empires of American commercial commerce. One of the people suing is the great-great-grandson, I believe, of Henry Flagler, who is the guy who started Standard Oil with John Rockefeller. Like, it was him and John Rockefeller. So, and he then went on to basically build Florida. I know that sounds a little simplistic, but when he died, there were stories around the country about the man who built a state, because he built the railroads down Florida, built all the hotels on the Florida coast, Palm Beach, where for some reason, a lot of these people are from, the plaintiffs in this case, live in Palm Beach area. He built this. I mean, we're talking, you know, the Standard Oil money alone makes him, you know, one of the richest people in American history. So his great, great grandson is suing. You have, a woman named, and his name is Lamont Harris. And his, you know, you have, Lynn Wheat, is her name, is another one of the people who owns one of these, you know, multi-million dollar mansions. Her boyfriend, partner, as best I can tell, is a billionaire. Her taxes, when the town sends her taxes for the property she owns on MDI, it goes to an address that is a $90 million mansion, in Florida, which her partner owns. these are in a lot of these people are just incredibly, incredibly wealthy. And I guess what the question I never really got a good answer for from them, the few I talked to who would talk to me, is why do you get to have a say? You know, like you don't live next door, you're down the road. Why do you, I don't even understand how you can sort of sue. I don't understand how they're standing. But I mean, you can, because basically you can challenge the planning board's decision is what this lawsuit was. It's challenging the planning board's decision. So yeah, I mean, these are a lot of, I mean, the guy who lives next door is Joseph Ryerson III, who's named after, his great grandfather, Joseph Ryerson, who started a steel company in Chicago, called Joseph Ryerson and Sons, that basically supplied a lot of the steel for the early Ford plants. You know, that's a huge empire of wealth. Mm. So yeah, I mean, a lot of these people have just, it seems simplistic, I guess, to just be like, these are super rich people, but like by all standards, not just Maine standards, like American standards, these are incredibly, incredibly wealthy people who, you know, have money to throw at a lawsuit. It doesn't mean anything to them because it's you know, town, $50,000 for a town seems like something, but for them, I don't think it really matters much. So yeah, I'm sorry. You probably
had No. So yeah, tell us about the reporting process there. And, you know, were you actually able to speak with any of the plaintiffs, and what did they, you know, what was their argument to you if you were able to talk to them?
Well, I tried to reach out to all of them, I believe. Two of them spoke with me. One was Mark Cannon, who owns a property a little bit down the street. He's one of the closer ones. So it's a little bit hard because And the other one I talked to was Stuart Janney III, who is chairman emeritus of Bessemer Trust, which is this finance outfit that has $200 billion under, $200 billion outfit. And who also, by the way, he is the owner of the 2013 Kentucky Derby winner, Orb, I think his name was, and is on the board of directors of the New York Racing Association for all the horse racing in New York. Big horse racing guy. So I talked to two of them. They, you know, they wouldn't answer some questions on the record, so it was a little tough. But you know, they basically, what they sort of said on the record was, you know, we're all for workforce housing. We all see the need for it. It's just this project doesn't make sense. It's too dense, and there sort of wasn't, you know, there wasn't enough sort of community outreach. Some of these, to be fair, like Stuart Janney and his wife donated to Island Housing Trust. They've given something like, I forget the exact number, but, or I should say the exact number hasn't been published, but, you know, something like $50,000 to this organization that's building workforce housing, you know, kind of away from them and a lot of the other rich people who gave to that organization, which include, by the way, Leonard Leo, who's sort of the architect of the conservative takeover of the Supreme Court. He has a place nearby. Also Dick Wolf, the guy who created Law and Order, also donated to Island Housing Trust. I really tried to go in and like, let's hear their arguments. Let's see. Let's give, you know, credibility to the idea that maybe this isn't a good project. It shouldn't be here. I never really heard a good argument. I don't mean to editorialize like that, but you know, they're just, it's too dense. Like too dense for who, the traffic, they did the traffic study. They kind of, it's pretty clear that it wasn't going to have much impact. It's six units. it seems there's a lot of like, I wouldn't want to live there. So therefore no one should. Yeah, I can't emphasize enough how much I really tried to write this and report it down the middle, but it's just, you know, sometimes one side just doesn't really make much of an argument. And that was the case here.
Hmm. Were they able to speak at all to their support of Island Housing Trust and some of the other housing initiatives on the island and their opposition to this particular project?
Yeah, I mean, they mostly used it as a way to justify their opposition, you know, because we're not against housing. They support this. I support Island Housing Trust because they, you know, their argument was that Island Housing Trust, they have built some workforce housing, but usually what they do is they buy or they get donated houses and then turn them into Island Housing Trust, into workforce housing. You know, using covenants. So they're converting housing that already exists into workforce housing. I mean, that's great. And that's, you know, good work. And that is helpful. But, you know, what we need in Maine everywhere is to build more housing. We need to increase the supply, sort of shifting around. The cost is great, but like, you need to build housing. And, you know, this is sort of the argument MD365 made, which is like, we have such a huge deficit here in terms of what we need, that we need to build as much as possible. And their argument was, you know, it's get down to 2 or 3 units and we're fine with it. We'll drop the lawsuit, essentially.
Hmm.
And the last, oh yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, keep going.
I was just going to say, so the last I heard, you know, this lawsuit's going on and there were some sort of negotiations between the plaintiffs and Mount Desert 365. Now, it gets a little complicated because apparently the Rails brothers, the sort of billionaires behind this who own a bunch of different property on the island, stepped back from that organization. They're no longer on the board of directors. And the executive director told me basically they were a lightning rod for criticism of this project, and they felt like they could step back and sort of not be a distraction. And I think the reason they were a distraction was because there was a lot of criticism, well, of MD365 as sort of a front for the Rails takeover of the island. And you know, they bought all this property and, you know, sort of a complaint against them was like, well, where's your master plan? Why haven't you shown us exactly where you're going to build in all these different places? And like, we don't know what you're up to. You know, I think MD365 was like, we're just trying to build as much as we can. There's no master plan. You know, we're trying to do this one at a time, figure out what works. So they step back. But what's unclear is sort of how much their financial commitment is gone now, or if it is. Because if they don't have that backing, then they need funding. And so apparently some of the plaintiffs offered to drop the lawsuit for some amount of money to the organization, to MD365. And now there's sort of, there was talk of, well, they'll still, you know, we'll work on MD365. The brand new president of the board there, chair of the board, told me they were going to focus on a different property. That basically this had got too hot. They were going to focus on a different property. I think there's a duplex there, 2 units that we're going to build and sort of put this on the back burner for now. I reported that. And then the subsequent reporting that I've read was that the town got pretty upset about that and was like, we're spending all this money to defend this decision. And like, you can't just step away from it. Like, we're the ones spending money in court. So they're sort of redoubling their commitment to it. The town is. But, you know, the thing about these plaintiffs, right? It's like they've said they offered money to this organization to get them to stop. You know, I mean, there's a word for that. You know, I don't, we all sort of know what it is, right? So it gets pretty dicey here, but this is, you know, you're very rich and you have money to spend. This is how you get your way.
So the project is on hold at this point. Where are we now? We're waiting.
It's on hold. The lawsuit is ongoing. It's going to, the Maine Supreme Court has not, unless they've put it on the calendar in the last few days, it's still not on the calendar. So it's going to be a while. They'll have oral arguments in front of the Maine Supreme Court, and then many months later, they'll get the decision. But but the organization has sort of said they were going to put it on the back burner, but now the town seems to get wind of that and just sort of angry about it. So I don't really know where it is right now, but it's certainly not sort of, there's no shovels ready to go. That's for sure.
I imagine once there are shovels, it will probably be much more expensive given the increase in building costs in the time since it was proposed.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, the delay, and that's part of the argument that MD365 has made and that the town has made too, is like the longer this goes, the more expensive it gets. Which, you know, could be sort of a legal strategy of the plaintiffs, right? Like drag this on, maybe the numbers don't work. Maybe it doesn't pencil out. If it gets more expensive, and then, you know, we've sort of defeated it through the back, you know, so to speak.
Yeah. But I live in Bar Harbor, for those who don't know, and it's obviously not too far from where this has been proposed. I can tell you that, you know, people were really talking about this story as soon as it came out a couple of weeks ago. What kind of response have you had from readers?
Been good. I mean, I haven't had anyone, you know, complain or threaten me. So that's always a good thing. It seems to be positive. I've got, emails, people sort of thanking me for writing it. And, it seems to be pretty good. So I think, you know, I think it just speaks to issues that people throughout Maine are facing.
Well, thank you so much, Josh. Before we go, just speaking briefly of housing, I want to let listeners know about a recent story by our Western Maine correspondent, Ben Hanstein, about the last remaining emergency homeless shelter in Farmington, which closed 4 years ago and has not reopened. That left all of Franklin County without an emergency homeless shelter, even as the number of people needing housing in the area has increased. You've been listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We were joined today by government accountability reporter Josh Keefe. You can read all of his work at themainemonitor.org and in newspapers across the state. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. If you have stories you want to share with Josh, you can reach him at josh@themainemonitor.org. The Maine Monitor Radio Hour is broadcast on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can listen on the WERU app, subscribe to the show as a podcast, or download archived shows at weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Kate Koff, and this is Community Radio WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill. Thanks, everyone.